You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Elephant in the Room by Tom Doughton. Leon and Musser have taken heat for publicly leaning into AI. Over the summer, the actor told New York Magazine that her neighbor, the late director David Lynch, described AI as neither good nor bad, just another tool for directors. Film purist accused her of leveraging the beloved director's cred to push her company. Musser maintains to me that Leon's conversation with Lynch did happen. The criticism clearly stung Leon, who was hesitant to talk. "I feel like you're going to pull quote me into a house of darkness." She only talked to Vanity Fair, she says, because Gordon Levitt, a friend, told her that he had. The accusations that Leon had become a shill for the algorithm, which briefly led to her comments becoming a meme on X, were largely unfair. Spending even a few minutes with her, an indie darling since 1998's Slums of Beverly Hills, reveals Leon to be a genuine and voluble cinephile. She meanders into film obscura, like the 1932 pre-code movie Call Her Savage, starring silent film star Clara Bow. Oh man, is she overacting in the scene with the Great Dane? Leon found the tech companies dismayingly derivative. She pointed to a viral trend earlier this year, when people fed their family photos into ChatGPT to remake them in the style of anime legend Hayao Miyazaki. "I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's charming. And I think pretty much anything is funny," Leon says. "I just actually find it, like, you know, just a bummer." Much like Gordon Levitt, Leon's issue is with data scraping. She applauded the Disney, Universal, and Warner Brothers Discovery lawsuits against generative AI company Midjourney, which has pushed back by claiming fair use. "Better the tech train only on the limited and licensed data available, even if it means it would create a less capable model. I love the idea of what this tech would produce without actually knowing any of that information," she says. "You'd have to train it quite differently. I'm not opposed to things that have nine fingers, for example. Maybe that's what this genre wants to look like." As for the haters, Musser divides the anti-AI sentiments into two groups. The top echelon of Hollywood, who are worried about their likeness being replicated by the tools, and a younger group of film traditionalists. He finds the first group selfish. They'll be fine no matter what. It's that latter group, the ones who piled on him and Leon, that he seems to have the least patience for. "Is Hollywood working for you? Are you working right now? Are your friends working? Does everybody have jobs? And it's working out awesome for everybody," Musser says, his voice gaining in frustration, "because it's not. This is your shot, and you've got the advantage," he went on. "So why not at least be open-minded to what about it could be helpful, rather than just being critical online?" A distinct genre. "So, just how many jobs will be lost?" Goyer says his VFX supervisor predicted that the budget for Foundation would drop by a quarter in the next year or two as the quality of the tools increased. "You're not going to need 500 VFX artists. You might need 200 instead. Katzenberg has gone even further, suggesting that in the near future, AI will do some 90% of the labor for an animated film. The speed at which the quality of the tools is increasing has astonished some producers. In Martin Scorsese's 2019 film, The Irishman, a 76-year-old Robert De Niro was de-aged using a three-camera rig and AI-powered software to make him look like he was in his 20s. Jane Rosenthal, one of the film's producers, said it was a painstaking process that required retakes and meticulous direction. Marty would say, okay, we have to do that again because you're acting like you were 40, but you got up like you were 70, she recalls. With the tech she's seen only 6 years later, Scorsese wouldn't have needed to give the same kind of notes. Rosenthal has been one of the bigger advocates for embracing AI in film. If you want to talk about it, then talk with knowledge, then talk with an understanding, she says. In the past couple years, at the Tribeca Film Festival, which she co-founded with De Niro, she launched an AI film tract. It's produced in partnership with OpenAI. She saw firsthand how high passions run when it comes to even discussing the issue. In 2024, when the festival hosted an AI panel with Sora, they had to ratchet up security, she says. Whether or not AI as a technology or a definable genre can overcome that label comes down to storytelling, says Aronofsky. The director launched a company, Primordial Soup, that partners with Google DeepMind to integrate AI in filmmaking. The company's unofficial motto is "Make soup, not slop." What's coming out of these machines now looks as good as anything Hollywood produces, but it's really just for a moment. It's for the 8 seconds or the 9 seconds that it exists, and it doesn't stick in people's heads, Aronofsky says. The race is on to figure out how to breathe emotion into that slop so that you can link shots together to start to tell stories. But even framing AI communities as a training ground for future mainstream filmmakers misses the point. The winners of AI film festivals are often people who come in knowing almost nothing, says VFX artist Ben Grossman. A past judge at festivals, he's been struck by how many of the standout projects are made by amateurs with tiny crews. I go talk to the filmmakers. So, how many movies have you made before? None. What did you go to school for? Not this. How many have you worked on it? Me, him, and my buddy over there. How long did it take you to do? Well, we started on Monday, and by the following Friday, we were done. For years, Grossman was a visual effects supervisor for directors like Scorsese, J.J. Abrams, and Jon Favreau, and he won an Oscar for his work on Hugo, a feature-length love letter about the technology of making movies. Then, Grossman quit. In film, we're just doing the same thing now, he realized. The innovation is gone. The new is gone. The creatives want to create cool stuff, but studios just wanted to make it cheaper. He since launched an immersive experience company, Magnopus, that he hopes will create a new genre of storytelling, one that combines the immersiveness of video games with the intimate storytelling of movies. AI, he hopes, comes to mean developing a distinct genre. A lot of focus right now for Hollywood is on how do we use it to make the old thing cheaper, Grossman says. But I think the most interesting opportunity is how we use the new thing to make something new. Bekmambetov believes there will always be a world of movies devoid of AI, a genre for traditionalists, like opera. It will be very, very valuable, handmade, organic. Confessions on a Dance Floor. Once upon a time, going out in Hollywood was actually fun. Derek C. Blasberg lifts the velvet rope for an oral history of L.A. nightlife in the 2000s, as told by the insiders who made it happen. Opening photos, find them in the club. Journey back to when T-Mobile sidekick launch parties ruled. Kim Kardashian was just Paris Hilton's brunette buddy, and ex-Mouseketeers Justin Timberlake, Britney Spears, and Ryan Gosling were all smiles. And in more photos, Brent Boldhouse, Amanda Demme, Perez Hilton, Carlos Lopez, Lisa Love, Jessica Weisels, Elliot Mintz, and Pantera Sara. In the early to mid-aughts, Los Angeles nightlife wasn't a marketing strategy. It was a ritual, a religion. This was a sweet spot of Hollywood's pre-streaming power, before social media and the World Wide Web broke the spell of secretive hedonism. Stars and starlets mingled with promoters, stylists, and publicists in dark rooms with strong drinks and weak camera flashes. They flocked to hide Teddy's at the Roosevelt Hotel, the Lounge, Joseph's, Le Deux, the Sunset Room, Area, the Chateau Marmont, places immortalized on the hills, in the pages of Us Weekly, and on fledgling gossip sites like TMZ and Perez Hilton. I can still see digital cameras catching the shine of MAC lip gloss, the shimmer of an Hervé Léger bandage dress undulating over a magnum of Grey Goose in a branded ice bucket. These bright young things texted on flip phones, smoked indoors, and the worst that could happen was page 6 mentioning a day later who they sat next to at a club. Tabloids couldn't get enough of Paris Hilton, now a mother and mogul who politely declined to respond to our questions. Britney Spears, whose reps did not respond to our inquiries, and Lindsay Lohan, who stumbled through the 2010s but came back looking better than ever in this year's hit film Freakier Friday. Still, her rep passed on participating in this story and CC'd a lawyer in her response. These weren't just clubs, they were stages, and the players who filled them were writing the last chapter of a bygone era. A world where celebrity was witnessed, not posted. Here, the promoters, PR fixers, club owners, and photographers who came alive at 1 a.m. reminisce about the golden age of naughty's nightlife. Brent Boldhouse, founder of Boldhouse Productions and Bungalow Hospitality Group. I remember moments in Hyde where I was looking at A-list actresses making out with two girls going, "Well, thank God there's no cameras in here." Jason Pomerantz, co-founder of Thompson Hotels Group. The only thing they really had to worry about was a flip phone photograph, and maybe somebody would call something into Us Weekly, which would run 4 days later. Carlos Lopez, photographer. I wasn't even 20. Everyone was underage, and at the clubs, raging. Elliot Mintz, publicist. There were lines outside all those clubs, like the Roosevelt and Teddy's. You had to really pull your weight. And that meant being a little bit more famous than the person who was standing behind you. Jessica Meisels, publicist. If you got into Hyde through that gate, you were in. If you were in that room, you were in that room. And we pretty much owned all those rooms. Rachel Zoe, stylist and designer. The party scene was everything. It was like entourage life, you know what I mean? It was like Le Deux was everything. Lisa Love, former West Coast director of Vogue and Teen Vogue. For me, it was always Le Deux Café, and that was before the Brent Boldhouses. You can't tell the story of L.A. nightlife in the aughts without Boldhouse, who got his start promoting grunge-era hotspots like the Viper Room and House of Blues, and his business partner, Jen Rosero. Boldhouse, I moved to Los Angeles to get sober, and somehow I fell into the nightclub business in 1989. J. Jen Rosero, partner, Bungalow Hospitality Group. Brent and I came together in 1991 and started off with Roxbury, like a night at the Roxbury. Bolthouse. What we did that was really special is we created a community. As people were arriving in town in the 90s, they grew up with us. I met Leo DiCaprio when he was 16. I did Paris Hilton's 16th birthday party. She grew up going to all of our things. And in those early days, we were handing out flyers, we were doing mailers. We would do stuffing envelope parties on a Friday night with Charlize Theron and Scott Weiland from Stone Temple Pilots. And these people weren't famous at that time. They were just kids trying to go somewhere. And then a couple of years later, they blew up. Rosero, I managed the door. My whole thing was to get the most interesting bowl of fruit, not all one flavor. You had to have a lot of different backgrounds. It wasn't just one type of person. Love, the Brent Bolthouse circuit, I feel like that really brought in bottle service. Bolthouse, I brought bottle service from Europe to America. I don't know what's going on in New York, but in L.A. it hadn't happened. We kind of invented it because I saw my friends in Paris doing it. Love, well, he didn't invent bottle service, but anyway, I think that's when the richer people would come. As Bolthouse and Rosero's business was on the upswing, a new generation of talent was coming of age in the scene they helped create. Lopez, I moved to L.A. in 1999. My first job was at the Tommy Hilfiger store on Rodeo Drive. I was folding denim upstairs on the second floor, and my best friend at the time, Madeline Morgan, this hot little blonde with blue eyes and a tiny little waist, was like, "Do you want to go to a party with me? Brent Bolthouse Productions is doing the party, and I'll bring you as my guest." I go in, and one of the first people that I meet is Nicole Richie. She roller skates up to me, which I thought was so iconic, and she's like, "Do you want to meet my friends? Okay, everyone, this is Carlos. This is Paris. This is Kelly," which is Kelly Osborne. "This is Kim," meaning Kim Stewart. Mintz, read Paris's autobiography. She speaks about her first meeting with me and why we decided that I would be her PR rep. It was after a burglary had taken place. This was even before the bling ring, and I had done some PR work for her sister, Nikki. We had a meeting, and I told Paris, "Do you ever worry about too much publicity, becoming overexposed?" And she looked at me and she said, "There's no such thing." Pomerantz, the Roosevelt was the first Hollywood project that got that new generation of celebrity. Hollywood was a little gritty still, and then the Roosevelt kind of exploded. Teddy's was the small, really exclusive part that became a celebrity haven. Amanda Demme, photographer and creative director, I brought in Jason Pomerantz at the Roosevelt, and I made it huge. Next, photos, high highs, low lows. Lady Gaga before the fame and the fame. Brent Bolthouse, Cameron Diaz, and Jared Leto. A blonde Lindsay Lohan and a blonder Hilton at a birthday celebration for the blondest of them all, Marilyn Monroe. Nicole Richie's ex-DJ AM, who died of an accidental overdose in 2009. An infamous tabloid cover. And it's from the New York Post, and it shows three of the aforementioned young ladies, and the headline is Bimbo Summit. Not very nice. An infamous tabloid cover, Carlos Lopez and Richie, and Jason Pomerantz, Jen Rosero, and Rachel Zoe. Pomerantz, let's just say the group had creative differences. I have since spoken to Amanda many times. She's super creative. She's really interesting. But there was a little drama there. Lopez, I want to say it was the opening night of Teddy's. I remember going with Lindsay Lohan, and I think Donatella Versace was there. It was a very hot night, very exclusive. And you would look around, and it was all the girls. It was like Misha Barton, Nicole Richie, Paris Hilton. Pomerantz, Leo, Lindsay, Paris, that group kind of exploded. They were going out all the time, and Teddy's was their hub. Kim Kardashian was just like a footnote. Mintz. I recall the first night that we invited Kim Kardashian to join us at Hyde. Kim Kardashian's first real job in Hollywood was building closets for celebrities. Paris hired her, and Kim worked diligently for weeks. Mizells, I had hired Kim, who didn't have a job at the time, to clean out Paris's closets because she didn't want to work at Dash. Mintz, one night when Kim was doing some finishing touches, Paris said to me, "You know that girl who did my closet? She's really, really nice. I get really good vibes from her. Why don't you invite her to join us tonight at Hyde?" Kim's first reaction was to look a little horrified. She said, "That's so kind of her, but I just want you to know I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't dance. And besides, look at me, I have nothing to wear." Paris said, "Oh, don't be silly. She doesn't have to smoke. She doesn't have to drink. Pick something of mine and change into it." As the visits increased, because Paris liked her and invited her to so many of them, Kim usually waited for the other women to enter first, and then she would walk in. Of course, no flash bulbs were flashing on this woman with the long brown hair. Lopez, these girls were unapologetic and very confident, and they grew up in front of the camera lens. And the more outrageousness and controversy there was, the more the world loved watching them. Mintz, I was not a partier as much as I was a guardian of the party. Father, confessor, public relations, spin doctor, whatever you want to call my role. For all those people that you can think of, Britney Spears, Paris, Lindsay. These women treated me not as a father figure, because their fathers never would have approved the behavior, but if there were any slip-ups, any mistakes, Elliot would find some way to smooth it out, to arrange a backdoor exit if a client was in such a state that it would do her no good to be photographed and pushed around outside by paps or fans, or to make what's called a trade-out paparazzi deal. Pomerantz, going out was super serious. The guy who was our doorman, a guy named Johnny Zander, was an ex-male model. I don't really know what happened to him, but Ben Stiller used him as the inspiration for Zoolander. Lopez, I'll never forget going home with Nicole after a club or a T-Mobile party. We would pull up Wire Image, and we would lay in bed and look at who was at the party. That was our pre-Instagram. Bolthouse, people were not paid to go to parties. That did not exist. Celebrities were coming to these parties because they were actually fun. Lopez, there were no contracts. You were going because you were friends with the owners. You were friends with the club promoters. I joke with people now, with all these 17-year-old influencers who are making $10 million a post, I'm like, I would literally get on a plane for a drink ticket. I would go to a club and a party, get wasted for 3 days straight, come home, and all I got was a hangover. Pomerantz, even the award stuff was fun. You saw actual L.A. fun people engaged in these parties. It was more organic. It wasn't quite so corporate. Lopez, I was one of the only people who was carrying around an actual little disposable camera. And then when the digital camera started to become a thing, I was the only one carrying that around. The air was electric with possibility, and it seemed any night could culminate in a private performance that had to be seen to be believed. Pomerantz, Prince would come in and just start playing a random solo show at Teddy's until 4 or 5 in the morning, just because he felt like it, right? And these things were regular occurrences. If you weren't at the Prince pop-up show, or you weren't there when Courtney Love showed up, it was gone. It was not on Instagram. I think that pushed people in L.A. to go out more. Demi, babe, I had Prince perform. I went nuts. I had the effing dopest shit ever. Pomerantz, Prince would stay up in the penthouse, which we had to redecorate to his specifications of white shag rugs and purple, and he would only eat pancakes for days. Lopez, the lounge is where the famous, infamous Brittany dance-off happened with Justin Timberlake. Thank you, I forgot his name. Bolthouse, Britney Spears was there. Justin Timberlake was there. They had broken up. Suddenly, the dancers are doing a whole breakdancing thing. The press goes crazy for it, and then SNL writes a skit. But it wasn't a dance-off between them. It was their dancers just showing off, doing spins and jumps and flips. Pantera Sarah, promoter, one had a table upstairs, and one had a table downstairs, and never the twain shall meet. They never were on the dance floor at the same time, so it was a completely made-up story. Lopez, Paris was having her 21st birthday, and she celebrated it in 5 different states and countries. I maybe went to 3 out of the 5. It ended in Los Angeles at a place called Sunset Room. Zoe, I had a big birthday party that Bizarre shot. Were you there? When I did the one with Nicole and Lindsay and Misha and AM DJ'd my party, it was the craziest party ever. It was me, Misha, Nicole, and Lindsay, and then everyone, the Olsons. I could have sworn you were there. Bolthouse, what's going to happen? Is Snoop Dogg going to get on the microphone and freestyle that night? Is Jay-Z going to show up and do something? All kinds of things would happen. Lopez, it was a full-time job. At the same time, the culture of the aughts could be unforgiving, particularly for young women. Love, it was not a period that I thought was really great in Hollywood. I thought it was the demise of the uncurated. That's not where you were going to find artists, actors, that actually were proper actors. It was a very dark time, I think, for young girls. Mintz, you'll notice that most of the people, if not all of the people, who took hits from that era and suffered through the scandals were women. There may have been one or two exceptions, but for the most part, it was girls wanting to have fun, to paraphrase an old song, by going out, having a couple of drinks, dancing, gossiping, and going home. Bolthouse, plenty of men were there, too. I just think that they didn't get the attention that the women did, because on that front, fashion doesn't care what a man is wearing, unless it's like Leo or Brad Pitt. Pomerantz, the Leos and the Jude Laws would come as well, but the women were more interesting because they were the ones dancing on tables. They were the ones creating the energy. Perez Hilton, blogger. Women can be guilty of misogyny, too. And Us Weekly and Star and all of the celebrity magazines, their villains or their targets were also women. And I had friends in all those publications, and it was predominantly female staffs. Lopez, Perez Hilton was the major enemy of every girl. Him coming for these girls started to affect their friendships. He would call it their flaws. He would call it their mistakes. The girls had to counteract him and create storylines, talking to the paparazzi and press to balance out whatever he's saying. Hilton, listen, I take full accountability for all my horrible decisions of the past. But they were all going out without underwear on, and part of me thinks they were doing that on purpose. It's like, oh, Paris got photographed without any underwear on. I'm going to get photographed without any underwear on, too. Bolthouse, I was in a bitter war with Perez Hilton because I wouldn't let him in to hide. I was like, well, dude, we say no cameras allowed and there's no press allowed. So he hated me. Maybe he still does. I don't know. I have no ill will towards him. Perez Hilton, Hyde got off on rejecting famous people. Poor Tara Reid was not allowed to go inside Hyde, but Paris Hilton waltzes right in. Lopez, Perez Hilton, he would cross my face out. Hilton, I might have. That sounds like something I would do. The paparazzi, too, became relentless. Mintz, in the beginning, I could walk outside and address the paparazzi by their first names. Mizell's, yeah, I had a whole list. You had some safe people that you worked with, and you knew who was bad. Mintz, it would be easy for me to spot a newcomer. The newcomers were incredibly young, and they wanted to get something different. And they were the ones who began shooting the women as they were getting out of their cars and looking for what was referred to in those days as upskirt photographs. Zoe, the girls were really pulled into the tabloid spotlight, and I along with them. So that was hard, because there was no social media. You couldn't control the narrative. Bolthouse, the line in the sand was Hyde. Harvey Levin used to stand outside with a camera by himself. Mintz. TMZ opened their offices directly across the street from Hyde. Hilton. Harvey met with me to pick my brain before he launched TMZ. Bolthouse. That's where Brittany didn't wear underwear. That's where Paris and Nicole had wars. And that is around the same time that phones got cameras. Rosero, at that point in time, you see that change where paparazzi will say anything to get the picture, anything to get somebody pissed off. TMZ made it harder for some of the higher profile clients to come out, let their hair down, and do whatever they're going to do. Sarah, it started becoming less respectful, and they would yell nasty things at Leo and his boys trying to get a rise out of him. If they get them angry, that photo's going to sell for more. The epoch may have reached its apotheosis on November 29, 2006, when the New York Post ran a now-iconic cover photo of Lohan, Spears, and Paris Hilton trapped in a car outside of an unnamed L.A. late-night spot. Mintz, I've been accused publicly of setting that up. Bolthouse, that was at Hyde. Mintz, we were at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Hilton, that iconic Holy Trinity photo, that was leaving Paris's house. Bolthouse, I think I knew that they were coming. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen in my life. They were being chased by at least 20 cars. Paparazzi got out and parked cars in oncoming traffic. Abandoned their cars on Sunset Boulevard, got out and then surrounded them. That's when that photograph was taken. Mintz, it had an unfortunate headline on top of it. It was called the Bimbo Summit, and the term was obviously derogatory. Rosero, I don't even remember exactly who it was. It was that crew that didn't wear underwear. It was actually dangerous. Not what they did, but the paparazzi was so crazy. Mintz, Paris and Britt got out of the room. I'm not certain if they took a window through the restroom or some backdoor route, but nevertheless, we found ourselves right on the street. And it was a moment or two later that I saw Lindsay approaching us from behind. It was raining hard, and I kind of sheltered Lindsay and walked her towards the car. And the paps were in full array, and they were screaming at Lindsay, who had been seen a few nights earlier voicing disapproval about Paris over something long ago and forgotten. And Paris said to her, because of the rain, just hop in with us. I moved around to the front of the car because the lights were really blinding and it was raining. And I said, you've got to give them some space because they were prepared to jump on the hood. Rosero, that was the thing about phones. Now the paparazzi can find out instantly where everybody was. I mean, PR people had a lot to do with this, too. Let me tell you, there were PR people that definitely were working to keep certain people relevant because myself and my crew were tight, tight-lipped. Mintz, I waited until they safely got out of there. I may have followed behind, and then the next day was the Post. Because I had been with them and because it got so much attention, there were those who said that I had arranged the whole thing, which I certainly didn't. As time wore on, the scene was also afflicted by the same demons that have struck down generations of partiers. Lopez, without naming names, I saw a lot of ODs. I saw people that are no longer with us struggle with alcohol and drug addiction. And I saw the downfall of some of these it girls when the fun started to be taken over by the addiction of going out. Everyone who knew when it was time to go home went home. And then there were those who didn't know when to stop. Mintz, it was no big deal to smoke a joint before going to a club. But there was a point where marijuana usage was beginning to erode and the influx of cocaine appeared. Pomerantz, I mean, generally, the after hours were not a good place to be. Mintz, people were a little bit more self-absorbed and people died and people went to jail and people spent endless cycles in rehabilitation or in courtrooms or worse. And the scene was no longer warm or cuddly or sexy or glamorous. Lopez, do you know what's crazy? Brent was sober the entire time and still is. The age ended, as all eras do. Why? Some blame smartphones, which robbed revelers of their privacy. Some blame social media, particularly Instagram, which launched in 2010, for transforming nights out into performative exercises. Lopez, Adam DeVello, who created The Hills in 2006, wanted to really capture this Los Angeles nightlife scene. And for us, it was like, oh, nightlife is starting to die. You're filming it. It's already starting to become covered and recorded. Mintz, admittedly, I haven't been to Hyde in 20 years, or the Rainbow, or the Roxy, or the Roosevelt, but I have a feeling that outside of a couple of straggling tourists, that scene does not happen anymore. Lopez, obviously social media really ruined Los Angeles, because nothing was private anymore. After this group of girls, it was the High School Musical kids, Zac Efron, Vanessa Hudgens, and Rob Pattinson and Kristen Stewart, and they weren't really raging, because I think they looked at the previous generation as kind of messy. Nowadays, no one knows where to go. There's nowhere to go. There's no nightlife in Los Angeles. Mintz, I think that there was a slow erosion. They were growing up, and it was getting boring, because it really was the same thing night after night after night. Not for dozens of occasions, but hundreds of occasions. Mizell's, it was an era where you would actually watch TV, and now it's like, I don't know the difference between somebody that's on Euphoria and Love Island. You know what I mean? Pomerantz, half the time we get hotel requests for influencers now, I don't even know who these people are. For every Timothée Chalamet, there's just a bunch of random Instagram creators. A lot of these younger, interesting actors are recluses, right? They're hanging out at Erewhon and drinking smoothies. Mizell's, even if you look at a publicist now, I would literally sleep for 2 hours and wake up, have a Coca-Cola and a cigarette, and start pitching media. And now, you can't even get a 26-year-old to do that. They would be like, I need my mental health morning. There's no sense of urgency. Love, I think there's definitely a cool scene downtown. There's dance clubs that are just bursting. There's Korean nightclubs that are insane. Demi, the nightclub people, it's a real breed, you know what I mean? It's a really beautiful breed of people. And the people that are in it, I still give so much props to, because it's a real thing. People don't really take it as seriously, but now it's cheesy. Everything's cheesy. Bolthouse, hopefully nightlife goes back to creating things that are fun. I don't know who's going to do that. It's not going to be me, I can tell you that, not at this age. Lopez, those were the days. Now I'm about to go have gluten-free food at Nicole's house with all these moms. Additional reporting for this article by Daniela Tiarina and Savannah Walsh. mid-century maison. For years, Nicolas Ghesquier had one very special West Hollywood house on his mood board. Paul Goldberger tours the property, newly restored by the designer and his partner, Drew Koos, that is now the couple's American home base. Photographs by Ethan James Green. Opening photo, very airy, Nicolas Ghesquier and his partner, Drew Koos, in West Hollywood. When you talk to Nicolas Ghesquier, who has headed women's design at Louis Vuitton since 2013, you realize his secret weapon, the part of his persona that allows him to withstand the pressure of producing major collections throughout the year. Under the most intense public scrutiny, is that he feels as much passion for the act of connecting fashion to culture as he does for the draping of fabric. For Ghesquier, fashion has never existed in a vacuum. His designs deftly blend traditional elements of Louis Vuitton, like trunk hardware, and the quatrefoil shape with references to futurism, pop culture, Japanese anime, science fiction, and modern architecture. Since 2014, Ghesquier had gazed at an image of a house in West Hollywood by John Lautner, the Frank Lloyd Wright disciple, whose designs have now become as celebrated a part of mid-century modern culture in Southern California as those of Richard Neutra or Craig Elwood. Ghesquier had never been to the Wolf House, which was built in 1961 for Marco Wolf, a concert pianist and interior designer, and at that point barely knew Los Angeles. But the moment he came across the picture, he responded to the intensity of the house, a tightly wound composition of stone, wood, and glass, perched on a narrow site high in the Hollywood Hills. Every Lautner house has considerable panache, not to say flamboyance, within the architect's striking shapes. There was a kind of explosion of space, and to move through it is to feel a sense of drama, brilliantly contained and controlled. We could tell the long, rambling story of the Wolf House and how it went through several owners, and how, like so many other classic modern houses in Los Angeles, it was treated with indifference for years before it was sold to Joaquim Ronning and Amanda Hirst Ronning, who renovated it. But it makes much more sense to jump to the end of the story, which you can probably guess. The house now belongs to Ghesquier and his partner Drew Koos, who never expected to see it, let alone own it. But in 2022, after spending more time in Southern California, where Koos, a communications and branding consultant, grew up, including chunks of the pandemic isolated with him in rented quarters in Malibu, we decided to get a house in Los Angeles, Ghesquier tells me. I had been carrying around that image of the Wolf House in my iPad for years and sent it to my agent to show her the kind of house I wanted, a landmark modern house that I could be responsible for. Next photos, the Wolf House unfolds slowly and cinematically between trees. And over the edge, the steep slice of land on which the house is perched would be considered unbuildable by many. Along with The Right Stuff, the influence of Frank Lloyd Wright, mentor of John Lautner, and pictured here, can be felt in this corner that calls to mind Falling Water, his architectural triumph. He intended the picture to make it clear that he and Koos were prepared to take on the challenge of some other mid-century architectural gem, strong, one of a kind, perhaps crying out for new owners who would carefully restore it. The picture was not supposed to serve as a shopping list, and anyway, Ghesquier's real estate agent had already told him that so far as she knew, its owners were happily ensconced in the house and had no intention of selling. She would look, she said, for something similar, and Ghesquier and Koos prepared themselves for a long wait. That was in October 2022. While Ghesquier and Koos were on their Christmas holiday trip to French Polynesia, they heard from the broker that the Runnings were relocating to Europe, and would lease the house and might consider selling it. Guesquier quickly changed his travel plans to go through Los Angeles on his way back to Paris to see it in person, and before long, he made a private off-market deal at a figure reported to be $11 million to buy the house. It was never officially listed for sale. Guesquier had fallen in love with California modernism a few years before he and Kuss met in 2020, when he visited one of the formative modern houses of Los Angeles, the architect Rudolf Schindler's house in West Hollywood from 1922. The Schindler house, a casual structure of tilted slabs of concrete, redwood, glass, and sliding canvas panels that the architect Charles Moore once called a bohemian shack, blurred the distinction between inside and outside. Guesquier was blown away, like Schindler himself, who had come from Vienna a century earlier to work for Wright. Guesquier was a European who thought he had arrived in paradise, to a place open to every kind of experimentation. From there, it was not a great leap to John Lautner, a Michigan-born architect who, like Schindler, started as an apprentice to Wright. Lautner was sent to Los Angeles to supervise the construction of one of Wright's houses and never left. Lautner's work, too, celebrated the openness and ease he believed Southern California represented, and seemed both to echo Wright's designs and to move beyond them into a kind of space-age modernism. The first Lautner house Guesquier saw was one of the architect's most memorable and certainly his largest. The vast concrete airship of a house the architect built in Palm Springs in 1979 for the comedian Bob Hope and his wife Dolores. For several years, Guesquier had been showing Louis Vuitton's cruise collections in notable architectural locations around the world and scouting them himself. "I wanted to do a show in California, and I had heard about the Bob Hope house," he says. It seemed exactly the kind of dramatic, slightly off-the-radar location he had been looking for. "I jumped in the car and headed to Palm Springs, and I booked a hotel so I could be there overnight and see it first thing in the morning," he says. The house did not disappoint. It combined two things Guesquier loves that rarely come together: a connection to old Hollywood and a bold, futuristic image. "And to think that it was commissioned by a couple in their 70s, he says to me. "It was my first experience with Lautner. We were mesmerized." Since then, Guesquier has staged fashion shows at the old TWA terminal at JFK Airport, now the TWA Hotel, by Eero Saarinen in New York, Louis Kahn's Salk Institute in La Jolla, California, I.M. Pei's Miho Museum outside Kyoto, Japan, and Antoni Gaudi's Parc Güell in Barcelona, all works by modern masters that, with the exception of TWA, are a bit off the standard tourist route. "I like having people get to an architectural location, to a place that is extraordinary, and then having them get to know it," he says. You wonder if Guesquier, if he were not so busy designing clothes, would be happy leading architectural tours around the world. He talks to me about traveling with Frank Gehry, with whom he shares a boss, Bernard Arnault, the chief executive of LVMH, who has commissioned the architect to design several projects. Most famously, the Fondation Louis Vuitton, the museum at the edge of the Bois de Boulogne, another extraordinary location in which Guesquier has staged a show. And the listener needs to recognize that this article went to print months ago. The 96-year-old Gehry, Guesquier says, has helped him to a deeper understanding of Los Angeles. "I love Frank Gehry," he says. "I cherish him." As for the Wolf House, Guesquier says it is a work in progress. He and Kuss have been building on the prior owner's work, tweaking a few details, updating the mechanical systems, and restoring the pool, a composition of white tile whose angular shape reflects the lines of the house, but somehow lost its original surfacing over the years, and they have brought in their own furniture, which is far from the cautious, consumer-friendly, mid-century modern furniture that fills so many houses of that period. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print-impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.